Well, thank you very much. I have to say that I'm not a scientist. I'm just a simple pediatrician, and sometimes I experience in this surrounding that I feel encouraged to think about what we are doing. But on the other hand, I sometimes also feel intimidated by a number of sort of scientific type approaches. And I definitely feel that there is a big gap between what we try to do in terms of interventions in the difficult contexts and the state of the art that is known in scientific settings. And I'm always thinking about how we could fill that gap, that those people who try to do something, in particular I will be talking about the HIV problem, how can we fill that gap in the sense that people who are working in it know about research results and things that are known, so that they do not need to go on doing things which are already known to be unsuccessful. I try to give you some more based on experience, more thoughts, and I don't know whether it's really appropriate to do this at this stage of a discussion, because sometimes I have felt I should rewrite that paper, which was written before I came here, and of course it does not contain what has already been achieved within this colloquium. But, well, let me nevertheless try. I have called the, I'm not using any PowerPoint, let me quote one Zimbabwean colleague who once was saying to a scientific audience, I am the PowerPoint, so try to do it without that. I gave the title to it, The Importance of Meaning in Dealing with HIV. And I would like to start to remembered a situation in eastern Angola in Mushiko province, which is at the border to Congo and Zambia, where I participated in a campaign to promote vaccination against polio. And that was in the context of a campaign for the eradication of polio, which was in a way quite successful. Now, this campaign was done in villages in eastern Angola, which is an area where the war was still going on at the time. Now, it's clear for medical and paramedical staff that if you want to do that, if you want people to vaccinate their children against polio, you have to build awareness first, and if you want them to agree to the vaccination. And awareness building consists in most cases of transmission of information. And as Western or Northern medical doctors, we believe that this information should be given according to scientific standards. And of course we know that a good physician does not necessarily know which methods are the best ones to transmit knowledge about a disease. And so we cooperated with people who are trained in education. And all this was correctly observed when teams arrived in the villages in Mushiko, at least those who were accessible during the war, and informed people about poliomyelitis. People were told about the virus, which caused the disease, about the ways how the virus could be transmitted from one person to another, and they were then informed about the existing methods to combat that virus, which was the vaccination. And the people who gave the information were respected by the people of the villages, so there was no reason not to believe them. And most mothers went with their children to have them vaccinated. And a high percentage even came back for the second and the third administrations of the vaccine. Nevertheless, I got the impression in that campaign that it did not mean very much to the mothers. They did not say anything against the information about the viral origin of the disease. However, the story about viruses answered a question they had never put. They all were looking for reasons for everything what happened. That's inherent to kind of Bantu cosmovision. The virus story, however, could not be such a reason. in the way how people in Eastern Angola interpret history and nature, a disease has a meaning. It is important to find out what that meaning is. The disease disturbs relationships in families and communities. It is perceived as an expression of something that has gone wrong in the relations between the living or between them and the ancestors. A mother whose child has poliomyelitis would rather ask, why is my child ill? And that means that she wants to find out what is the difference in her family from others. And the story about the virus does not answer that question. In spite of that, poliomyelitis has been successfully combated because people do not resist the vaccination. So why should we care? Now, I think that it is more complicated if we look at the human immunodeficiency virus. There is not yet a vaccine, and even very optimistic scientists tell us that it will not be available within the next 10 years or so. And once it will be very expensive and so not available to all those who need it. So we have to reply to other types, we have to rely on other types of prevention. There are more than 20 years of experience of HIV prevention behind us, yet the number of success stories is very low, and even in the case of these success stories like in Uganda, we cannot yet really be sure that this decrease in HIV prevalence is the result of prevention interventions, or of which of the prevention interventions it is the result. On the 7th International Conference on AIDS Impact that was held in Cape Town in the beginning of April, Jeff Fisher from the Center for Health and HIV Intervention and Prevention at the University of Connecticut was very critical with existing prevention interventions. He called them intuitive and atheoretical and, quote, not informed by the state of the art behavioral theory, end of quote. As a result of that, Fisher pointed out that many interventions are not tailored for the respective target population, only provide information, fail to motivate preventive behavior, do not teach behavioral skills, and are not rigorously evaluated. Fisher presented an answer to the problem with a model that had been developed in the United States and is actually adapted in Africa, the Information Motivation Behavioral Model. When I listened to Fisher, I was not sure whether this model would really fit to the situation I had met in Southern Africa. However, the approach to the problem seemed interesting to me. He was saying that the prevention interventions only provide information, and this indicates clearly that information as such is apparently not enough, and interventions are not tailored for the specific target population. And I asked myself whether it isn't strange that many people seem to believe that the same tools can be used all over the world if we are intervening in very substantial matters of societies and individual persons. There are campaigns which are called social marketing of condoms. The penetration of market terminology into all areas of human life is really amazing. Sometimes when I have traveled to rural Mozambique, I wondered whether young people would not be tired of the intensive propaganda about condoms. Songs, theater, posters talk about condoms everywhere. Why doesn't it work? In rural areas of Zambia, I found the message more concentrated on abstinence. Young girls and boys in schools, 6 years old, sang songs about abstinence. And the older ones told me that it was better not to have any contact with people of the other sex. They were afraid of any type of relationship. And I started to get afraid of these people, thinking of them as future adults. What is going wrong with such simple rules like the famous ABC, standing for abstinence, be faithful, and condoms, and now sometimes being extended to D for delay sex and E for early testing? It is surprising how little we know about what determines people's sexual practices in African countries. We do not know much about the understanding of sexuality, love, relationship, and reproduction. Most anthropological and ethnological books about African societies have been written by missionaries who were precise observers of many practices, but apparently not very much interested in the sex life of those whose souls they wanted to win. And maybe that is because they were not very clear about their own sex life and its meaning. I'm not saying that the elements of A, B, C, D, E are wrong, or that I can propose other solutions. However, what I have seen indicates that the A, B, C, D, E message cannot come across as long as we do not take into account what the meaning of it is for the people whom we are talking to. The main argument against this whole reflection is the emergency. In an emergency, you cannot look for reasons, background, or context. You intervene. And in the case of a burning house, you extinguish the fire first, and then you try to find out why it burned. There is no doubt that AIDS is an emergency, at least in sub-Saharan Africa. I believe that in writing. However, we have been fighting the fire for 20 years. And what if we have been fighting it with petrol instead of water? And I think that is the main concern, that our interventions for prevention are not only unsuccessful, but that prevention interventions might contribute to the spread of the virus. Rainer Grönemeyer, professor emeritus of studies, a sociologist and theologian at the University of Gießen in Germany, reminds us in his book, So stirbt man in Afrika an AIDS, that's So People Die in Africa of AIDS, of the structuralist view that historical eras have their own characteristic diseases, quote, which belong to its physiognomy, like everything else they produce, like its arts, its strategy, its religion, its physics, its economy, its erotics, and other expressions of life, end of quote. AIDS might then be the disease of modernity and globalization, and it seems to confirm this view that some Bantu languages use the term modern disease for AIDS. It is interesting to listen to the different names people give to the disease or its threat. Modern migration, or trafficking in sub-Saharan Africa, trafficking of persons, forms of movement which are different from earlier forms of migration in which whole communities or clans change locations, have contributed to the dissolution of social structures in which people felt safe and at home. This is one of the characteristics of modernity in that part of the world. I do not want to idealize old or traditional social structures. However, saying that modern dissolution of social networks contributes to the spread of AIDS does not necessarily mean that these networks were ideal social structures. Grönemeyer states that there is something like a social immunodeficiency which would support and strengthen the human immunodeficiency. And if he's right, one of the consequences should be that the struggle against the human immunodeficiency virus has at least to include empowerment of societies and all communities in order to reverse the social immunodeficiency. And that cannot work without understanding what people's interpretations of their own context are. Now, until this moment, I have not even mentioned the scientific mind, although this term is in the center of this colloquium. The organizers have wisely refused to provide a definition of the scientific mind before. However, they have given some guidance. And I quote from the first announcement of this colloquium, which said, "We may assume, though, that most will agree that it has, among other things, to do with not taking things for granted, questioning any given truth, being inquisitive, seeking connections and patterns, and being relentless and methodical in asking questions." End of quote. As a European citizen with an academic education, not being a scientist, I can happily adhere to this tentative description of the scientific mind. My question here is, does that help in combating AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, where I work? And I would like briefly to concentrate on one of the elements of the above-quoted tentative definition, and that is questioning any given truth. Now, doing this certainly requires a feeling of safety. I assume that part of that is material safety, and if I do not have to care about the next day's food, I can afford to not believe what others tell me to be the truth. The European Enlightenment has emerged in a cultural context with certain liberties. Culture is able to move, to change, and so to advance and possibly reach higher levels of development if it is not threatened. Amilcar Cabral has described colonialism as a violent external termination of a people's own history, and he concluded that the struggle for liberation would be a fundamentally cultural act in which people try to restore their cultural identity. Attempts of liberation have widely failed. This is not the place and the moment to discuss the reasons for that. However, if we follow Cabral's interpretation of foreign dominance, we find African cultures more than ever under threat. It does not make much difference whether the threat comes from a foreign country or from a capital city in a formerly independent state, which for most people is as far away as colonial power ever has been. And we all know that foreign domination has not ceased with the departure of colonial rule. I'm not saying here that the indigenous culture is good and the foreign dominant culture is bad. However, even if we think that the Declaration of Human Rights is an important achievement, we still have to recognize that some elements of it are not culturally accepted in many sub-Saharan African societies. And following Cabral, I would assume that the reason for that is that these African cultures have been constantly under threat of extermination, which is why they did not have a chance to move and try new concepts, set new steps, and take risks. While it is true that the inner Africa has only been colonized very late, and that in these areas much of the very ancient culture has survived, I would defend the thesis that colonial rule, although it was fully established only at the coast, has nevertheless been felt all over the continent, and it has not succeeded to destroy the cultures. However, it has had a very strong impact in preventing these cultures to be flexible and able to take risks. People have become rigid in defending their cultural identity. Now, I do not think that it is possible to make these people question what they believe is the truth, because their truth has always been questioned by others, and many of these others were violent intruders and still continue to be, although their forms of violence may be more subtle. And the other truths which have been offered to them have only worsened their lives. That is why I do not believe that we will be able, nor that we should try, to make them change their minds to be scientific in the way we understand it. People from different cultural backgrounds listen to us in private and can be even curious to know about our ways of interpreting phenomena in the surrounding world. However, in order to do that, they need to trust us. Their trust is then the basis on which they also can afford to question their own visions. And in order to create their trust, we, the interveners from outside, have to become trustworthy. And even if we personally may already have that quality, we have to recognize that we are part of a long history which has destroyed trust. It is necessary to take the threat away from the cultures which have been dominated for such a long time. To do that will be very difficult and highly controversial, because it implies not only to take the threat away from those elements of culture which we agree with. Historic collective experience plays a very important role. when the South African government at the end of the 80s of the last century started to give information about AIDS, this could only be understood in the context of the still existing apartheid regime. Government, this, I quote from a book that's written about that problem, government efforts to promote AIDS education and prevention programs in schools and elsewhere were at best ignored, at worst counterproductive, end of quote. And AIDS, quote again, was said to stand for Afrikaner invention to deprive us of sex, end of quote. People who said this were not stupid or ignorant. They had an experience which made them question the truth which was offered by those who suppressed them. It may be easier for us to deal with the minds of those people who currently intervene in African countries in order to reverse the development of HIV prevalence. And for them, I would like to add an element to the tentative definition of the scientific mind. They need to be curious. They need to want to know what the context is in which they want to intervene. I do not know any other tool to prevent the spread of AIDS than abstinence, which I think is not a very promising concept, because I continue to believe that sexual relations are part of human nature and culture and contribute to pleasure and strength of human life and condoms. However, in order to convince people to use condoms, we have to understand their views on sexuality, relations, love, reproduction, and a lot of other issues, which may be important for their lives and their understanding of the world around them. We need to take the people who are addressed by our campaigns and projects, and even by our research, more seriously. Would only to mention one, if possible? Yep. One other element, and that was a very interesting contribution to the International Conference on AIDS Impact that took place in April in Cape Town, and there was the presentation of a young South African researcher called Terry Ann Selikoff, and she had done research on prevention programs under the ABCDE concept in Alexandra, that's one of the four so-called townships near Johannesburg. And her findings made her say that this concept is, quote, a simplistic approach to a multifaceted problem, end quote. She argued that the context of sexuality had to be taken into account, comprising hermeneutics, symbols, meanings, with all their cultural specificity, as well as structural elements, which she described as more external. For South Africa, she stressed that the need to consider the historic mistrust towards any kind of authority, which has consequences, for example, in schools, the disintegration of families, the breakdown of traditional socialization structures, and the lack of educational and employment opportunities. She found out that trust was considered to be important in relationships between men and women, and that trust was seen as opposed to condom use. Sex was particularly by young people often perceived as proof of love, which led in many cases to early sex and also to sex without condom. These are only examples of determinants of people's practices. Prevention appeals, which do not address them, are not likely to be successful. Selikoff therefore proposed the development of what she called love literacy, taking the notion of literacy from the understanding of power play. And that means that all practice and all language is seen in its relation to other social practices, and that action is united with critical reflection. Instead of the simplistic ABC or ABCDE, we would then come to a different alphabet and look at the meaning of many letters in that alphabet, like the T for trust or the M for myths, and myths not only in the sense of erroneous belief, but in that of the socially constructed nature of sexuality. The P for power, the G for gender, the E for education and economy, the N for new forms of masculinity and femininity, the F for fear, and many others. I do not know whether love literacy can or should be part of the scientific mind. it seems to me that it can be an interesting idea to develop further. And part of the reason for that is that it expresses a profound interest in those who are struggling with HIV and empathy, which may not be scientific, but which I would like to see included into the scientific mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Ra, for contextualizing our debate in the framework of a very crucial issue.